This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
So today we're behind the scenes at Stargazing Live at Jodrell Bank Observatory, and we're joined once again by Matt Taylor. Welcome to Jodcast.
Thank you for having me.
You've been on here once before.
Yeah.
We found you twice, but we haven't put that episode up yet.
It happens. I get around a bit.
So have you been doing quite a bit of outreach recently, ever since Rosetta blew up?
Well, so far it hasn't done that yet. But I know what you mean. It has a certain popularity associated with the mission, and much more than any of us really considered. For one reason, this is the second time I've been on Stargazing Live. I don't think I would have been on Stargazing Live for the other missions I've worked on, although I should do, because they're fantastic missions. But Rosetta has something that certainly people are interested in. Maybe the peak of interest was in 2014 because of Philae, but 2015 has seen Rosetta doing a lot of fantastic science, continues to do science, and now we're extended, and now we're actually in the extended mission in 2016, so we're going on to the end of Rosetta, and I actually wrote it in an email today that for me personally, I think this year is going to be pretty hectic for Rosetta, in that we're going to get as close as physically possible to the comet with the Rosetta spacecraft.
Is this extended mission extended targets that you might not have actually reached, but because the experiments performed admirably, we've now come to the point where we can do some extra stuff?
We were nominally, the nominal mission was funded until the end of December 2015. That was based on a particular timeline ages ago, before launch, really. And yeah, with the science, you couldn't say no, I think. And we've ultimately, I mean, it's only a small extension for 9 months up to September this year. But still, it's pretty good.
So what are some of the highlights of 2015?
Well, we had perihelion in August, so we got to our closest approach in the sun with the most activity of the comet. And that's, you know, so when we first arrived at the comet, we're talking about, 300 grams of material flying off per second, and that went up to tons of material flying off in August. We had a nice show from the comet, in terms of the amount of this material, how it was coming off. In fact, this material, the dust and the gas was causing a problem for us navigationally. So in March last year, we actually had to go further away from the comet than we expected. And in the end, we spent a lot of time last year over 100 kilometers away from the comet, which is okay, but we would prefer to be closer. And that was one of the fundamental points of coming into the extension in 2016. When the activity dies away, that we'll be able to get super close, back up close and personal with the comet to really have a look at it and really, really find out what's going on in that near comet environment. Because that's the key for the science. Although, in spite of not being able to get close, we've still done a lot of stuff. And when you see the ground-based images, the you can't see the nucleus. You know, we're right in the middle of all of that stuff that you're seeing. And I think some of the images that I was given or passed on today for stargazing from Alan Fitzsimmons and Colin Snodgrass, I've got some stuff in Tenerife for the Liverpool Telescope and the Newton Telescope showing the comet from the ground. I think only last week or even this week. The tail of the comet's millions of kilometers now. You know, it was, I remember saying it's 150,000 kilometers, thinking that's quite big, but now it's millions. It's huge. Of course, comet tails can go much, much bigger than that. I think, if memory serves correct, Ulysses detected one that was something like, was it over 3 AU in extent? So yeah, they can get quite big, but this one, seeing it from the ground kind of then puts you, and when you put it into context that Rosetta's still in the middle of all of that, it's still blows my mind.
And how much of the comet's material is actually being lost in the tail? Because such a long tail, that's a lot of stuff. How long does it take before the comet shrinks to nothing?
Well, I mean, the thing's 10 billion tons, so if it's losing a couple of tons of material, you know, every apparition, of course, there is a big peak in activity and it drops down again. Mm-hmm. And that material is loosely bound in orbit with the comet. That tail grows because this, you know, there's a distillation, as it were, gravitationally of this stuff, and it gets dragged around the orbit. We see that with all comets. That's why we get some very nice light shows every now and again of this stuff re-entering from different comets. But that's the formation of the tail. In fact, when we first arrived at the comet in 2014, we were seeing some of the dust that had been emitted the last apparition. That was kind of bound loosely to the orb, you know, it was outside of about 150 kilometers. We were seeing this stuff that was just with the comet that is in the same orbit. So it's ejected and then kind of hasn't got enough energy to do much more than hang around in the same orbit, and you get these massive debris trails that we pass through on with the Earth on with other comets every now and again.
Has Rosetta ever passed through the tail itself?
This is something we are doing at March-April time period. We'll actually fly into the tail, which for some people isn't as interesting. So some instruments, because we're going further away, it's, you know, it's not really what they want to do. Maybe some of the images won't be as striking, but for me, they will be. One of the main drivers was to look at the plasma interaction, actually, to go through the tail in any way to see what that tail environment is like. Again, there's this, from the plasma perspective, you look at this as a non-magnetized body that's being interacted with a plasma, with a magnetic field, and you can see how that evolves, you can see what kind of phenomena are occurring, which can be applied to all over the universe, effectively. And so that will be interesting to see what the effects that we see on the tail side. We had hoped maybe to see some kind of reconnection or anything like that, that you'd see when you have a body in the supersonic flow that is the solar wind, you tend to get similar phenomena. There are lots of differences, but you'll get things drape. You'll get the magnetic field draping around the comet. You'll get these plasma interactions and these boundary waves forming, and we want to see what they're doing in the tail. And possibly you see reconnection or merging of magnetic fields, but just generally seeing that phenomena, that dynamic interaction in a different place. To be honest with you, one thing I'm actually interested in, to see if there'll be a change in the way that some of the dust is behaving as well near the spacecraft, because we see, it may not actually, but there are lots of things going on around the spacecraft that are perturbing measurements. And one of them, we think, may be that we're having dust particles actually broken up by the effect of the spacecraft being in the solar wind, that it actually causes a kind of electric charge around itself. And you have this electrostatic potential, which may be destroying dust particles and making them break up and maybe preventing some of them from getting near the sensors. So there's all things like that when you're in different locations, you may get different effects occurring. So we're interested to see what those kind of things will be going on. But once we've done that, we'll come back, we'll hopefully do another flyby near to the comet, and then we'll gradually spiral closer and closer to the comet over the subsequent months up to September.
Will there also be a little bit of actual pressure when passing through the tail? Will you have to keep a close eye on your navigational systems?
The main problem we'll have, actually, is we are restricted in terms of all the navigation is done with being able to see the comet. So that's actually the key thing, is we have to see some part of the comet. So we couldn't fly it. We couldn't go through eclipse, for one thing, because that's just not possible. It's a bit too dangerous to not allow the spacecraft to have any power. But really, the navigation is done with... we have to see a certain part of the comet. And, of course, when you're on the tail side, you don't see much of the comet. So there are certain things that have restricted us as to what we're doing. We will, yes, as I say, I think the eclipse is the main thing that we want to try and avoid. But in terms of perturbation on the spacecraft, it should be minimal because we're going, I think it's a good couple of hundred kilometres down tail. So most of the activity, most of the action is occurring on the day side. So it's kind of, we'll see the contrary to that, but we hope to see some other interesting phenomena.
And while Rosetta's doing all these cool measurements, what's Philae going to be up to? Or what is Philae up to now?
Well, since July, so we had, after the landing, it went into hibernation, and we heard a peep out of it, a couple of peeps in June of 2015. We had a couple of those up until July, and that was the last time we heard from it. So you have... it's a bit like, well, it's Schrodinger's cat, really, but we can't lift the box and have a look. It could be alive, it really is. In this, there's this duality about it. You could explain the fact that we haven't heard from it in the fact that, we were very far away, it was highly active, it may have been covered in dust, so it's more difficult for the signals to get through. It could be that in July it just stopped functioning completely. There were some issues with the transmitter chain. As I say, we don't know anything since July. We were in the right kind of position in the last month or so to hear from it. We did. There was something. Something went on in December on board Rosetta, but we think that was due to the fact that we're actually kind of playing with the antenna that listens for the lander. So we think it just heard something else. Exactly. So we gained interference from something else that could be mistaken for a signal from the lander. So, ultimately, we haven't heard anything. And to be honest with you, given that we've gone below 100 kilometres and in June, July, we were at, between 100 and 200, we were in the right place at the right time, at the right altitude, and still didn't hear anything. Kind of makes you think, well, it's unlikely it's still functioning. But we were still trying things. So the lander team were commanding things, even though they had no response. So they do the functionality of the system was such that you kind of handshake. So you ping and then you have a ping back and then you say, right, okay, we're in contact with one another. Now we send commands. After July, when we weren't getting this response, they started doing things called commanding in the blind. So they'll send signals down without requiring to hear from the lander. And that happened a few times and we've never really heard anything back to indicate that something, you know, something was responding. Certainly there's an instrument on both the orbiter and the lander called CONSER, which is like a radio tomography experiment. And you can command that and get a signal from it separate from the other chain. That didn't do anything either. So there are things kind of, once you add all that up together, indicates that maybe...
Might be dead.
Eternally asleep. Yes. I mean, this is the thing. So yeah, it's... Yeah, I mean, it was in a dodgy situation. It was, you know, it was on its side. It was not the best place to be. Although, for coming into long-term science, let me put it that way. But it was great for the science, ultimately, through the landing week, because it was in a place that we could have never have wished to aim for. Because it was really primordial. The stuff there was very different. We got to sample two very different regions on the comet up close, which was really good.
Did you expect there to be two regions that were so different?
Well, I mean, we could see even from, well, before August when we got to 100 kilometres in 2014, you knew that they had this diverse morphology and terrain on the comet, and that's become ingrained in all of our minds now. You see all these differences. But actually being able to say, well, we'll land there, then we'll skim across here, and then we'll end up in this hole on the side that's got a completely different appearance and different maybe physics and chemistry. I'd say more the physics is different that has produced those that environment was fantastic. Although, you know, on the other side, we weren't able to do some other experiments, but it's very popular. It has been popular, and there's still a lot of science to be done. Even with that, whatever it is, only 60 hours of data in total. You know, some of those instruments were only sampling a little bit of that, but there's still stuff to be done, just on the lander.
And so as it gets closer to its sort of swan song, what is the science you're going to be focusing on when you get closer and closer, closer than you've been before?
Well... not being able to get close means what you have is when you have this stuff emitting, so you have these volatiles, these ices sublimating into gas, and the chemistry within those molecules evolves. The molecules break down, so you have parent and daughter molecules, and they evolve just from, you know, from an altitude perspective. As they're going out, they'll change. And so getting closer, you start looking at the parent, what were the source of some of these molecules. Also, how the coma works. So how this sublimation process and this ejection of material, what is this? Well, they call it the acceleration region. It's very close to the comet, within about a few radii of the comet. Getting to sample that properly, hopefully we can do that. But really, it's getting as close as possible, because then your signal-to-noise ratio for some of the in-situ measurements will be fantastic, in particular the mass spectrometer. Now, we've had some fantastic results from that instrument. They really are... hitting some of the, you know, the primordial target, you know, or the, how can I put it, the origins of the solar system type question. So looking at, well, we had this deuterium to hydrogen ratio measurement, looking at the different types of water, which were the first indication that this comet was likely not to be similar or to have been connected to the Earth, because there's all this big question about what has delivered life, what has delivered, or the building blocks of life, what has delivered water to Earth. Maybe, well, this was showing that this particular comet or its friends, or the comet and its friends, this class of comet, may be not a predominant delivery mechanism of water to Earth. Although there is a complication there, because there are other members of its family. It's a Jupiter-class comet that Herschel showed to have water similar to Earth. But there was that was the first thing that was basically saying, well, the key point of this water measurement was it showed that the comet was very old. It was a Kuiper Belt object. It'd been on the outskirts of the solar system for a long time. Then there were a number of other molecules it was looking at. It actually found argon as well, and that was showing that it's old, that it's been out on the outskirts. Nitrogen measurements were also saying the same thing, kind of disconnecting it from Earth, actually, quite a bit. Then, most recently, we showed that that molecular oxygen was on the comet, and quite a lot of it, compared to what you may expect from general cosmological chemical evolution. You know, oxygen reacts quite readily with everything. So why are you getting this persistent source of oxygen from the comet? Basically showed us that for it to be there, or the conclusion of the paper was, it had to have been there from the beginning. So it hasn't been generated through reaction of radiation from the sun, etc., with water. It's actually, that was embedded in the protoplanetary disk. And also that for that to happen, you had to maybe tweak your models of how the protoplanetary disk was working to form the sun. So that was a real we're getting real primordial material on there. And then they use that result, or I'm going on quite a bit about the Rosetta instrument, but they're cool results. So you've got this molecular oxygen, and then they use that result to go back to Giotto results on Halley and show that actually because the instrument on Rosetta is better than the one on Giotto, they were able to say, well, there was that peak in the mass spectra. Now, given the context that we have and the measurements on Rosetta or from Rosetta, go back to that and show that Halley appeared to have oxygen as well. And that really throws into the mix that you say, well, okay, these Jupiter-class comets, like 67P with Rosetta, appear to have, or at least this one has got molecular oxygen and quite a bit of it. You could extrapolate and say maybe a lot more of them have. Then now you find a completely different comet, Halley, has got that type of, or has got molecular oxygen on it as well. And so it's kind of, again, looking at these, what we call the origins questions, how the solar system formed. Well, they're big questions, and we started to tick them off. And actually today, there's a release. I'll better jump into another instrument quickly. We've been looking at how the comet works, how this emission of volatiles, so all this gas, how do you make a comet into a comet? So it's not an asteroid, it's a comet, because it's got all of this stuff kicking off, all this dust and gas coming off it as it goes closer to the sun. How does that activity, how is it driven, how does it work? And so you think, well, we need to see some ice. Or how does that work? How does the ice transfer into a gas? And we've seen with the Virtus instrument, which is an infrared instrument, but also the OSIRIS camera, evidence of surface ice. Certainly, well, with OSIRIS first, you can see these bright patches, say they might be ice. You need Virtus, an infrared experiment, to look at the emissivity, you know, to look at the spectra of that, to say, well, actually, yes, it's definitely ice. You can only do it with an infrared spectrometer. So we've identified, and there's a Nature paper coming out this evening that basically says, yes, we've seen ice. We've completely identified it. And that instrument, Virtus, was also looking at how you a water cycle on the comet as well. And this came out a couple of months ago. In that, for some of the dusty layers. That kind of shields or retains the heat a little bit on the surface of the comet. So you'll get heat injected, you'll start heating up volatiles, so the ice underneath the surface, or within the surface, that starts sublimating, the ice becomes gas and starts flowing off. That continues, though, when you go into the cold because of this dust layer. And so you retain some heat and that continues, and then what you end up doing is refilling the surface and causing kind of frost effect on the surface, because this gas is being emitted even when you're on the dark side. And of course, the surface drops temperature very quick, even though the internal is still warm. So you get this temperature gradient, and actually you get a frost layer. And so you see that there's a cycling of the surface layer of ice on the comet, but only in certain regions. It's in the neck region where it's very dusty. But then on the bum, or the bottom, or the belly of the duck, I should say, we have these more defined regions of ice that are caused by these big cliff features. Talus, is it? I can't remember the geological term. So basically you've got like rockfalls, for want of a better term, and you see this ice coming from these cliff faces, and there is a different set of it's a different process in action there to generate again this activity.
So it seems to be like a remarkably, for such a small object, it's quite a remarkably diverse range of stuff going on.
Yeah, there's so many different processes. Yeah. I mean, another one that comes to mind, which I think is quite cool, we see a change in rotation rate. Yeah, so it's got faster, and now it's kind of slow. That rate of change has stopped, and it should slow down again. Yeah. And that has been shown, that you can drive that change in rotation rate purely by the shape of the comet alone. So you could say this is a completely uniform object made of all the same stuff, but just by saying, here's its rotation angle, here's what it looks like when it goes through perihelion, what the illumination profile is through that period, and you can change the rate of spin purely just by illumination from the sun. You don't need, like, more bicarbonate soda on this side or whatever, whatever chemicals you want to think about, whatever volatiles. It's purely by the shape alone. And we're seeing, and it's very nice for the guy, Uwe Keller, who wrote the paper, because he keeps saying, you know, he'll come up and say, see, it's agreeing with my line plot that he did in the paper before we went through perihelion, and everything's matching very nicely with what he said. Of course, there's a little bit of a deviation, but it's fantastic to say just the shape alone does that. And so you have to take all of that into consideration. So there's dust layer in the neck, you have different types of ice processes, and then on the belly, and all of this links into one another. It's pretty cool.
So I guess you guys are going to be taking all that into account when you sort of plan the final trajectory to crash into the comet. Do you know roughly whereabouts Rosetta
Stone. Actually, unfortunately for everyone who asked me this, and for me, that's the bit that we haven't really planned. Everything else up to then is kind of, well, we're going to do this, then we're going to do that, we'll do this flyby, then we'll do this spiral, then we'll do this mapping orbit, and then we'll gradually, then we'll do an elliptic orbit in Terminator, and then we'll go down and try and get down to a circular orbit within 10 kilometers, and then go closer if we can. Then we'll break into this other orbit and gradually try and get the spacecraft closer and closer. And then there's a 2-week, we're still looking at it, period for flight dynamics in Germany, who are then saying, well, this is how we'll do the end bit.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, we'd already said, you know, they'd said, where would you like to land? And we it's plus or minus 6 hours, the rotation of the comet period is 12 hours. I think they'll get it down a bit more accurately than that. I think we should be able to target reasonably well. So far, I think most people have said, put it on the head, try and get it near the lander. For the science, you know, some science might, you might say, put it somewhere else, but the thing is, it wasn't designed to land. Yeah. It's a controlled impact. We should hopefully get as much data as possible as we're approaching. But I think emotionally one would say, well, let's put it on the same lobe as the lander in case it breaks apart, because it's this bi-lobed object as well. So we think it's two cometesimals. Yeah. So if it breaks apart, at least the spacecraft will be together for eternity until the comet dies and then whatever. But yeah, at the moment, no solid plans for that bit, but
okay.
Ultimately it will be somewhere on the comet.
Will Rosetta stay active at all as it begins to crash? Would you possibly find a skimming and get some more strange data that you weren't expecting?
We will try to be in contact with it and as close to the surface as possible. But yeah, again, one of the challenges for that period, that last 2 months of the spacecraft's life, are really being determined by the flight dynamics guys are trying to work out the best way of characterizing the near comet gravity. Because although it's a very weak gravity, it still will have very weird effects when we get below 10 kilometers. And so, you know, it's going to be a weird time around then. But we want to try and get as close as possible. The discussion is do something so we can get as close as possible. And then from then on, you know, people have said, well, what about after it hits? It's highly, highly unlikely. I mean, even if it just went, the solar panels have got to be pointing at the sun and the antenna to Earth, and this thing's rotating. It was not designed to go on the surface. So I'm very much more interested in a bit before that. But and then we'll see the signal go, and frankly, I would say a majority of the team, maybe all of the team, will then be in tears. I know, talking to the people that have worked on it for their lives or most of their careers, that they look at that point as a low point in some sense. In particular, I say for the guys that do the operations. So because for that really is the end. But then all the scientists are like, will be turning around and saying, oh, right, we can't have any more data now. We really have to look at all the data we haven't had time to look at.
Yeah.
And then bang, that's where the science really leaps up.
And you must have enough data to last many, many years.
Decades, I would say. You know, I mean, there really is. And, you know, I can't put a number on it. You could probably say that it's this many terabytes or this many gigabytes
this
of data.
Many PhD
but, well, yeah, it's that, yeah. I mean, it's for me, and in particular, you say one of the problems maybe, and this is a political statement, I would guess, that within Europe, one would say, we haven't got a chance of getting another comet mission in the near term because everyone will say, well, you've had Rosetta, you don't need another one, which is unfortunate because we've learned a lot of lessons and everyone knows exactly what they want to do with the next comet mission. So, yeah. But who knows? But there's certainly going to be a fantastic amount of data to wade through.
Hopefully you'll find something in the data that will motivate another comet mission.
Well, I would think that we've already done that already.
Well,
just from what we've done. But no, there are already questions that need to be, you know, from what we have now, you'd say, well, we could do this differently. We want to do this. You need this instead. I think to add there, it's not just Rosetta itself and the fillet data. You would say you want to consider that puts all of the ground-based observations in context as well. So we have a lot of coverage from the ground at the moment. I think I mentioned that earlier on. You take all of those and kind of bootstrap or calibrate the ground-based measurements, because you make all these assumptions on what the dust production is, etc. You've got a better idea when you're sat next to the thing, and then apply that to all of the other ground-based observations of all of the other comets and even the other cometary missions that we've been to. So you add all that together and it really broadens the scientific impact of the mission.
How long was the Rosetta mission in the works for before the launch?
Well, I think I show this when I give public, and well, basically my standard talk has got a slide from 87, I think. So it was just after the Giotto-Halley encounter with a report of a joint ESA-NASA report of the mission as it was then, which is actually a comet sample return. So it was in the 80s already. We were saying, well, we've got Giotto, but this is what we really need to do, was a comet sample return, which was way too extravagant, and we went for what we have now. But yeah, it takes a long time to plan these things.
So even if you get some speculative plans together, in 20 years' time, the public may have forgotten about this, and maybe you'll get some more funding.
Well, the thing here is, it's more to... Well, you have to put things in now. You have to start planning the mission because it takes so long. Mm. To be honest with you, that's not a... Well, you want to have it in your plan, but Rosetta changed its comet 1 year before launch because we had a problem with the launcher, so we had to actually change it. That's another thing, actually. Mm. But things were planned for a smaller comet. The comet we were going to, Vatanen, was about a kilometre across. The one we went to was 4 kilometres. So there are some things we had to tweak from a mass perspective in terms of the lander had a harder landing because it was designed for a different comet.
Why did that plan change?
It was because the launcher, there was an issue with the launcher that we were on. So as soon as that happened, you delay and there's a ripple effect. That means, right, you can't launch on that date. That means you can't go to that comet, quickly redesign your mission. But going back to the point on future missions, we go through the process within ESA at least, where the science program asks the science community to propose missions. And there have been some cometary missions, but at the moment the direction's been, there have been other things selected basically. They're still undergoing study, but there wasn't in the last call any cometary missions selected. We'll see. I think there should be another call this year, so we'll see. But this is for medium, what we call medium class missions, which are around, I think it's 500 million euros, which is not a Rosetta mission. Rosetta was a big mission. It was one of the cornerstones at the time. And I think we used the figure of 1.3 billion euros, plus a couple of extra quid now. There were some proposals put through for main belt comets. So looking at these asteroids that have characteristics like comets now, so we're starting to see those kind of effects occurring. But yeah, there are some of those things going on, and NASA are looking at things as well. But from a European perspective, there is nothing in the pipeline yet. And that's what I wanted to say in a very long-winded way.
Do you have an idea of what the flavour of the week is? What they're going to be going for next? Or is it?
You can't say. It is a roll of the dice. And having been within that environment many years ago, when I was working on my true love plasma, there was a mission that was the next generation of the cluster mission, which is a full spacecraft magnetospheric mission. We were doing something called Crosscale, which was going to be multiple clusters around one another to look at all the different scales of plasma. So the fluid scale, the ion scale, and the electron scale. And yeah, you don't know what's going to happen. We weren't selected, that's why I'm on Rosetta now.
Fair enough. Yeah, no, I think it's...
That's really good. So
sorry for going on to that.
No,
that's all right. So what will you be working on once Rosetta crashes? Obviously, what data will you be looking at?
Controlled impact. Programmatically, I will remain on Rosetta to ensure that... part of my job will be to ensure that the data that we're getting back is as good as possible. So that's for the archiving process, still stimulating the science and the interest in the mission. Actually, I should have said, one of the other results I think was cool was during perihelion, we had these massive outbursts occurring. One of them was so extravagant that it actually pushed the solar wind away from the comet. And we had wanted to get very close to measure this plasma interaction where you actually have a void in the solar wind caused by the comet being there. And we thought that would be within about 30 kilometres, and we were at 400 at one point, thinking we're never going to get there. But then we got down to about 200 kilometres, and this big lump of bubble, not lump, this big collimated jet of material flew out and actually pushed the solar wind away. So we actually went through that cavity. It's called a diamagnetic cavity. We thought we'd have to get close, but actually the cavity came out and met us, so that was a nice one as well. But I thought I'd better add, because it's a bit plasmary.
And yeah, just one quick point. As you said at the beginning, you've been doing a lot more outreach. You've been on Stargazing Live twice in the last two episodes of Stargazing Live. Do you think this is gonna? Do you want this to continue? Do you want to keep doing more outreach? Do you think you're?
I don't like
talking to you.
I'm fed up talking to you lot. No. I treat it as part of my job. I don't. It's difficult to say I don't enjoy it, but I don't like doing it.
You don't seek it out?
No, put it that way. I know people will say, but look at him. I don't. But it is part of what we have to do.
So the BBC asked for you?
Yes. Buggers. but it is part of my job to ensure, well, it's a bit like you saying, oh, nobody's been talking about Rosetta, but I think, well, I disagree with it, but certainly the interest has gone massively down compared to around the landing, because people are fixated on this, and still trying to remind everyone that Rosetta is not a NASA mission, that kind of thing, and that there are not aliens, and
they've
this
gone,
kind of
they've
thing.
They've got an ESA flag in Kabul now, so...
There you go. See, we've made something. We've done something. We've done something. It's, but yeah, that, I, speaking to a lot of people, and some of the interactions I've had with people, because Rosetta has enabled me to engage with people that have not considered science at all, have not been interested in science. Something happened with Rosetta. I've been able to engage people that I know for a fact hadn't considered science ever. And now, I feel that that's worth continuing, but it is an extra task on top of everything else I'm doing. So I was having a, before I came here today, when I was at work, in the Netherlands this morning, talking to my manager about a trip I'm doing next week, which is actually a programmatic trip. So I'm going to go to a New Horizons meeting, but kind of saying, yeah, but then you're going to Germany on the Friday, and then you're going there the week after, and then you're going there, and you told me you were going to reduce your travel because you were complaining you were traveling too much, and then you weren't seeing your family, and you weren't being able to do your job properly, and blah, 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 blah. And the mantra in my house is it'll be over in September. So, but I think at least operationally that that intensity will certainly drop down soon, because for one thing, and I think I tweeted it the other day, we were talking about high-level plans. So that's why I said, well, we'll do this, 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 and this, because that's roughly what we want to do from the science working team. The scientists want to do these kind of things. Not everyone wants to do it in the team, but this is one of my jobs, is to make everyone equally unhappy. So we've got to that level, and so once that starts to consolidate and solidify, that level of intensity will drop off, and it will be more the general, what I'm used to from 4 years ago, the general running of science, and maybe do something else.
Good luck in the future anyway. Hopefully we'll grab you once more for the Jewelcast at some point. Who knows?
This is it. I mean, Rosetta's dead next year, so they're not going to invite me back.
Eternally asleep.
Well, yes, sorry. Yes. Well done. Well remembered. That's it, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Cool. Awesome.
Excellent.